This is AENN, American Exceptionalism News Network.
Hello. In the traditional motion picture story, the villains are usually defeated. The ending is a happy one. I can make no such promise for the picture you're about to watch. The story isn't over. You and the audience are part of the conflict.
One more real quick. Paul Wildcard 2, come on the line from Yuba City, California, and talk to us for just a minute, because that's about all we have.
Thanks for having me on. The way I look at this is that basically, as the president, we have a hybrid. We have somebody who grew up with Frank Marshall Davis, who's a communist, and also with the anti-colonial edge, which is directly linked back to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is directly linked back to the Nazis. And what we have is somebody who's a national socialist. And you can see how he drives his agenda. Also, as the president, he has been linked directly to the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, if you take a look at Benghazi, which is now turning out to be nothing more than Fast and Furious on steroids over in Europe, you know, you've got a president here who's got a clear agenda. His behavior patterns, all the things that have been going on with all the school shootings, all that stuff fits the same thing as what you saw in Hitler's Germany. And he's basically using the same tactics that Hitler used to take over Germany. It's being applied here in the United States.
That's an interesting point. Thank you very much for the call, Paul.
I know some people want me to bypass Congress and change the laws on my own.
It is the agenda for the 21st century you're living in today. For a brave new world where everything that you cherished and held true will no longer exist.
In the original Constitution, I think it is an imperfect document, and I think it is a document that reflects some deep flaws.
And that would authorize him to use the military to arrest people in the United States who, in the president's opinion, are enemies of the country.
You'll find that they've also asked for the right to imprison farmers who wouldn't keep books as prescribed by the federal government. The Secretary of Agriculture asked for the right to seize farms through condemnation and resell them to other individuals. And contained in that same program was a provision that would have allowed the federal government to remove 2 million farmers from the soil.
New government Republicans and Democrats were busy shredding the last vestiges of the Constitution. They're talking about inserting the army into domestic law enforcement. The homeland is part of the battlefield, and people can be held without trial, whether an American citizen or not.
I have been often to, the mothership in New York City, but it's good to have an outpost of the council right here down the street from the State Department. We get a lot of advice from the council, so this will mean I won't have as far to go to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future.
Take off the tinfoil hat and put on the Kevlar. It's time for battle with Paul Preston and the Agenda 21 Show.
Well, hello and welcome to Agenda 21 Radio. This is the radio show that is stopping totalitarianism one exceptional American at a time. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, are you that exceptional American? I suspect you are. That's why you're listening to this radio show. So welcome aboard. A lot of things going on. George Bush, 41, the senior, who brought us United Nations Agenda 21, and arguably the consequences of so many things that are happening around us right now. And I say arguably, because, you know, carbon credits, think about California, the type of state that it's becoming, regionalism, all those things, George Bush the senior, and Nancy Pelosi working hand in hand brought us in the last couple hours. We've been talking about that, and you actually heard them talk about one world order, and then you heard Nancy Pelosi back in October of 1992 bring in H.R. 353, which codified the United Nations into United States law. She's the one who brought it. Nancy Pelosi, yeah, and she's still around. That was 1993. Now it's 2018. You do the math on that about how long she's been around. She's an important lady in terms of United Nations Agenda 21. Anyway, with us right now, though, is Ken Boone. And Ken Boone is a victim, if you will, of the fire up there, the Camp Fire. in Paradise, California, and he joins us here on Agenda 21 Radio. And Ken, welcome. I'm so glad you're safe and sound.
Good morning, Paul. I am too. That makes two of us who are glad that I'm safe and sound.
And I know a lot of other people that are very, very happy that you're with us, and we have prayed for you. We were looking for you, and turns out you happen to have been in a Red Cross shelter in Oroville, California, and we were all very relieved to find out that you were okay.
It was an amazing thing. Started out with a real barn burner of a day, and then the whole dynamic changed at the Red Cross shelter, and I was it was not a painful, it was a distressing situation, but certainly not boring.
Yeah. Well, tell us about, this is November 8th now, and I had gotten, this is an odd thing, but I'm in my studio and I'm preparing for the show, and I got a signal. I have certain people who signal me about different things globally. It's kind of interesting. And right. I was getting a little chime up just a little before showtime, before 6 o'clock, that there was a potential fire in Polga Gap down by the Camp Creek, as they call it, Highway 71, which is, of course, the Feather River. The Feather River brings in water to Oroville Reservoir. And you lived in Magalia, is that correct?
I lived in Paradise.
Paradise?
North of Billy, west of Skyway. That was 27 days ago that you were preparing for a program, and I was looking to the east and seeing a golden, abnormally golden sunrise.
And by the way, it's a beautiful area up there where you just described. And I just, my last trip up there, I've been up there five times since the burn, I went right down Billy Way, that whole area. I drove right up Magalia down and all that stuff. But
I have lived there for 28 years. This event happened 27 days ago. And in those 28 years, I have always referred to it, like you said, as beautiful paradise. Now it's, used to be beautiful paradise.
Yeah, it's, and I mean, really, it looked, as the pictures don't do it justice. Being there says everything. It looks like a nuclear wasteland. Like
really?
A nuclear bomb went off. Yeah, it really does. The high heat and everything, it's pretty obvious there's a lot of high heat going on there. Tell us about your experience, though, shortly after 6 o'clock.
Well, I noticed a heavy golden glow on the west wall of the dining room, and that sent me looking east toward the sunrise, and sure enough, the sun was there, but it was shrouded by what looked like heavy smoke. I thought, I get to keep an eye on this. But I went in and I took a shower, prepared for the day. And then when I came back out about 15 minutes later, the smoke was about 1,000 feet overhead moving. That'd be west. And I just had a bad feeling about this. In the past, people of Paradise have this false sense of security that says, oh, yeah, there have been fires, but they never get us. 10 years ago, in 2008, there was one that came and took out fewer than 100 homes around the perimeter. You remember that one?
Yes.
We grieved with our friends and family members who lost homes, but you know, we rebuilt and recovered, and for the most part, we've just been fat, dumb, and happy. But on November 8th, 27 days ago, that was going to be a hard left turn, a sharp change in our lives.
Well, I was in the first big fire I was ever in was in 1969 in Southern California, and I can remember we were awakened by helicopters, Huey helicopters from the Marine Corps base flying overhead telling us to get out because of a fire. And I remember looking at the walls of my bedroom, and they had that same, they were a little bit more red than gold, but it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. And of course, we knew something was up. And soon enough, you know, everybody's packed up and headed on down the hill, but the traffic was a problem. Now, when did you first decide to leave, and at what time was that?
Well, let me back up to 10 years ago. You talk about the helicopters and the noise that awakened you in the late 60s. There were no helicopters this time, but 10 years ago, there were emergency vehicles that were coming up and down the lanes of Paradise. They had their lights on. They had bullhorns, and they said, evacuate, evacuate. There's a fire coming. And so I went out, and I assessed the situation. I didn't see any flames. I didn't see any smoke. it was several miles away, but they were doing this as a precautionary measure. So I talked to one of the cops. I says, do I really have to leave? He says, well, it's not mandatory. We're just asking you to, if you, it's optional right now. So if you want to stay, you can. If you want to leave, you can. So I stayed. And this is what probably half of the people I knew and interacted with did. They just hung around and didn't see any immediate danger. So that contributed to the false sense of security that we had 27 days ago that morning. I did make the decision after a phone call arrived with a caller ID on the screen that said code red. And the words, as best I remember them, Paul, were, because of the fire, that's the way it started out, assuming that we all knew that there was a fire. Not everyone did. Because of the fire, we're asking zones 2, 3, 5, 7, 9, and it mentioned probably 6 or 8 different zones of paradise. I'm in zone 1, wasn't aware that I was in zone 1, but I knew that something was up when that call came, and they were not asking for me to evacuate in the northwest corner of paradise. But judging from the neighbors who were throwing their stuff in their cars and preparing to move out, I thought, I have more than a bad feeling about this now. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to check with my friends Clay and Mary on the east side of town, because it looks like that's where this is happening. And sure enough, that was where the fire attacked in 2 prongs. It split on its way over to Paradise, came up and hit the south part and the north part. So I called them up. I got them en route on Billy. They were headed west towards Skyway. I said, hey, what's this I hear about a fire? And it's looking kind of yellow over in the eastern side. They said, it's true. We are in the car. We're headed for Skyway. We're going down Skyway. We're out of here. The flames are up to Feather River Hospital on the south, and on the north, they're up to Noble Orchard. I said, you're not kidding me, are you? No, leave. We're out of here. God bless you, and we'll talk later. Click.
Can I stop you there for a second? Because what happens is the winds were, the fire was being blown up from the canyon floor from Pulga. They crested on the mountain ridge there, which is above Concow, and the flames were basically being thrown across the Concow Valley, as you said, in a 2-pronged attack down towards the Feather, the hospital, and then, of course, up by the orchards, which was leading into Magalia.
Yes. But and Magalia got its share of fire and destruction, but it was nothing like Paradise did. So with those, it wasn't the phone call, it wasn't the visual, it wasn't the code red phone call, but it was the words of my friends Clay and Mary when they were escaping that helped me to make a decision. And it was within 5 minutes that I was in my truck and headed down the road. During those 5 minutes, I grabbed my Bible, I grabbed a loaf of bread, 2 bottles of water, my coat, hooded coat, and insurance papers, and as an afterthought, and a flashlight. As an afterthought, I also put in an external hard drive, which had critical documents and audio files on it. In fact, it was my whole life on that little 1 terabyte hard drive. And if there are people who are listening who don't back up their files, I want to urge them to save all those pictures, all those critical files on some little hard drive that you don't have to worry about taking the whole computer. You just pop this hard drive in your pocket, and when you need to leave, wherever you're going, it's with you. That's the reason why my life and the work that I do, the ministry, has a good chance of recovery. It all fit into a backpack, Paul. I threw it in the truck, and I headed down Wall Lane, no problems, took a left on Billy, headed east toward the fire, towards Skyway, which was the escape route on Billy, and encountered traffic of probably 200 yards, 150 yards on this side, on the west side of Skyway. I crept up there as they were trying to funnel incoming traffic in with traffic coming down from Magalia from the north, squeezing it into a gridlocked pattern almost into Skyway. And when I got to Skyway, I was probably three or four vehicles in front, and this is what I saw. It was getting dark when it was supposed to be getting light that morning because there was indeed fire. There was smoke, and it was getting closer by what seemed like the minute, getting darker by the minute. There was not panic, but there was confusion. And there was shouting as law enforcement people tried to get these people to move it. We're not taking questions here. Just drive. Yes, move it. Drive south. We're getting out of town. There are 50,000 people in Paradise and Magalia and Upper Ridge towns that need to get out now. And people would stop and they'd say, do you have any information about, and the cops would just say, come on, let's move it. Well, this is a serious emergency. Well, I wasn't joining the exiting mob. I had made a decision 10 years ago in the 2008 fire that if that ever happened, joining the herd in gridlock, headed out on either Clark, Pence, or Skyway was going to be a near-death experience. So I had a little conference with God. I said, I'm going to abandon this truck. I'm going to park it here at this secondhand shop away from the traffic. And I'm going to take my stuff and I'm going to walk. Is that all right, God? And the answer came back, yeah, go for it. And don't forget your flashlight, which I almost forgot. So I parked it and hoofed it across the intersection with the help of that flashlight that pointed me out to cops and traffic that was doing a crush load down Skyway. We're talking about counterflow now. They're using all four lanes. The oncoming traffic is non-existent. They're just using every bit of lane space that they can to go south. That worked great till they got down to Elliott, and we can talk about that bottleneck that was created when they restriped and recurbed that section from Elliott on Skyway down to Pearson, which was supposed to make it better, but actually it just bottlenecked the traffic.
It served as a choke point is what it did.
Choke is an excellent word. So anyway, I wasn't going to be a part of that. I was walking it, got my cell phone, by the way, that was one important thing, walking it east on Billy, past Skyway, up the hill, and I'm just walking past cars that are just absolutely stopped, waiting to get down the hill onto Skyway. My destination, as I had planned from 10 years before, was to go to the Alliance Church, which is a large church in the center of town with a huge parking lot, safe from the flames. If everybody did that, it wouldn't have worked, but that was my own personal plan and the plan for the family. And so I walked that direction, took some phone calls, one from particularly a confused friend who said, I have abandoned my car, too, just because of the traffic. And which way do I go? I said, go west. The fire is coming from the east. Go west. So we hung up, and that call came back a couple of times as that friend sought specific direction. I ran into one lady who's walking on Billy. She's west of Clark. She's between Clark and Skyway. She's headed for Skyway. She says, what are you doing? That's where the fire is. I said, lady, think about this. I'm headed toward the Alliance Church. There's a huge parking lot there. It's 150 to 200 feet from the edge of the parking lot to any place near the church. So that's where I'm going to shelter in place. She says, oh, my gosh, we're all going to die. I says, think about it, ma'am. The choice is yours, but I'm going for the parking lot. You want to join the mob down on Skyway? That's your choice. Are you coming with me, or are you going to go with the traffic flow? And she turned and she walked away. I don't know what happened to her. By the time I'm up to the Mormon church and a hospice area, which is probably 100 yards from Clark, I'm headed west on Skyway, there were flames. and I saw the flames. They had jumped from burning embers that were coming across that had not reached yet Clark, but these burning, they were more than embers. Sometimes they were just chunks of bark or something. But they would, apparently one of them landed behind the Mormon church, lit up the mobile home park back there. And that's when I first saw the flames. And I thought, boy, this is, when you see the flames, that's not theory, that's practice. It's real. So I strode up toward Clark, took a left, walked past the post office, went to the Alliance Church. And I'm looking at the traffic on Clark, which is as headed south, which is a parallel to Skyway, as jammed up as Skyway is. And these people are confused and they're frantic, but they're not panicked. There's no collisions in that area at this time, but the people are, they're intense. So I walked into the parking lot, not a soul around. But then I looked back toward the flames, and by now I'm looking west toward flames from the parking lot of the Alliance Church. And I began to snap pictures with my cell phone.
And I've seen some of those pictures. It's very, very compelling pictures. Whatever happened to the traffic? Did it finally clear, or what happened?
It cleared about midday, about 12:30 or so. I had posted... the cell phone service was still up, so I'd posted pictures on Facebook from the very location before the cell service went down around 10 or 10:30 and the electricity went down. To a select few friends and family, I said, I'm safe, but paradise is burning, so please pray for us. To answer your question about the traffic, began to fade. I say about 12:30, I made the decision to go back and to try to rescue my truck because I talked with daughter-in-law, Adina, and she said, you know, that is shelter for you as well as transportation in case you need to get out of town sooner or later. I said, but I'm safe, you know, again, this false sense of security. About 12:30, I had talked with people, I'd prayed with people, and let me tell you, when there's trouble, people are interested in praying. Again, I had another conference with God and said, I'd like to go get my truck. What do you think? He said, oh, go for it. So walked away from the church, which is the safe shelter-in-place zone, and I walked past the post office where the landscaping is on fire, Paul. Landscaping makes flames maybe 5 feet tall, nothing like a pine tree that's 120 feet tall that burns like a matchstick when it's ignited for about 15 or 20 seconds until it's just a smoking hulk with covered with little burning embers. But I was witnessing that. So I walked past the post office, sidestepped the burning landscaping. It was unlocked. It was dark. I thought, man, this is a defining moment. I've been here for 28 years coming to get my mail. I think I'll check my mail. I went up to my post office box, opened a little door. Sure enough, there's a couple pieces of mail in there. So I stuck them in my backpack. It's surreal. There's not a soul around in the post office. Usually it's got people and the lights and activity. It's just me and this darkened post office where the boxes are. So again, I stopped and I knelt down and I prayed and I said, Lord, I have been here, coming to this little box for almost 30 years, and there have been listener support and encouragement and contact through this place here. I don't know what it's going to be like tomorrow, but once again, I'm putting this into your hands. I'm glad to be safe. I pray for the people who are, they're going to be people who die today because of this. And so I'm just seeking your care and your protection, committing this day to you and this little walk back to fetch my truck. In Jesus' name, I prayed, amen, and went on, sidestepped, again, burning landscaping. And by that time, I'm dealing with smoke inhalation because the flames are driven by gusts of 40 to 50 miles an hour. And when one of those would blow sideways, no matter where you are, if the smoke was going to cover you, it did. So I would try to deal with that by taking as big a breath of fresh air before these big clouds of smoke would come down at ground level. And usually they'd last for maybe 2 minutes or so. By that time, I'd had to exhale my fresh air and then just inhale through a sleeve to filter it as much as possible, that smoky air. I didn't realize the damage that smoke inhalation can do to a person in a day-long situation like that. So I coughed and choked for probably 2 weeks after that. So I'm walking along Billy. There are a couple of homes that are completely engulfed in flames. And again, Paul, it's a surreal experience. They're on the south side of Billy, probably a block west of Clark on my way to Skyway. And the heat of these things and the trees that are burning behind them is intense. It's stinging my face from the other side of the street. And there's not a fear, but there's a deep sense of awareness and concern and alertness. It's sort of like I got to keep looking 360 degrees around me. The sounds were terrifying, but I was not afraid. I'm hearing the sounds of explosions, a lot of hissing, the sound of propane tanks roaring because the pressure valves would pop out of them, and then they would ignite, and they would turn into little rockets that roar around. I heard the sound of ammunition caches that would sound like popcorn in the distance. Fortunately, I didn't get close to any of those, but I could hear them from maybe a half a mile away. I didn't want to encounter any shells or casings blown out of those. And there were these explosions that happened about every, maybe in the middle of the day, every 10 seconds, maybe every 5, sometimes every 15 seconds. And it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. So I wasn't afraid, but there's a little kid in me that was fascinated with this. And I'm thinking, well, I shouldn't stand here and watch these houses burn, but I'd never seen anything like this before. There's no fire department because they've been reassigned to remove the people. Forget the fire. It's overwhelming. So
let me ask you about the explosions, if I could. How did that work? I mean, where were the explosions coming from? Were they these buildings blowing up?
They were buildings. They were automobile fuel tanks. Some people say they were transformers, but on the phone poles. But I never saw one of those.
I never saw one in my 5 trips up there. And I was up there 2 days after. I never saw one of those transformers exploded. The contents out or anything like that, not one. And I saw, of course, that whole town up there was wired for that. It seemed like there's a transformer on every pole just about, but I never saw one of those exploded.
So to tell you, answer you as honestly as I possibly can, I heard more explosions than I saw. Occasionally I would see an eruption of flammable liquid in some home someplace. And that day, within a mile around the church, I witnessed perhaps 20 homes that were fully engulfed. No fire department. They just burned in silence. Well, it wasn't silence, but they just burned without any concern. I mean, I was the only guy walking down Billy. And people are just, I'm contrary to what the rest of the crowd is doing, and I think that's one of the reasons why I was saved. Anyway, I stood and I watched these two homes side by side, and there's a beautiful new pickup parked there, abandoned. I'm thinking, oh boy, mine's over on Billy and Skyway. I hope I'm getting the same treatment. And it was flaming from front bumper down back to the windshield. So the whole front end of it's on fire. And I'm thinking, okay, well, it doesn't take a dummy to figure out this is moving toward an explosion when it hits the fuel tank. So I'm going to step it right along. So the fascination faded as common sense took over, and I strode down Billy back towards Skyway. And by that time, it's midnight dark. The smoke has totally covered the town. I've got my flashlight, and if there's any light at all, it's like the dim light of dusk, but right before it gets totally dark. So this fire truck rumbles up and passes me, stops, and backs up. And I see on the door, it says Richvale. And Richvale is about 30 miles west down in the valley. That's where they grow the rice, you know, the Lundberg family farms. So this is the one fire truck, and they've come along with many convoys of fire trucks from different places. I'm seeing signs on the sides of these fire trucks that say Oakland and Hayward and Shasta and Redding, and they're just moving in to help us. And I stood at attention and saluted these firemen, and the looks on their faces, the jaw drops on these firemen were just like, whoa. I mean, we're totally taken by this fire. And their responsibilities were to get the people out. They were not to fight the fire, which was unfightable. So one of the firemen rolls down the window, sticks his head out and says, you got a car? I said, well, I'm moving toward my vehicle. It's parked at Billy and Skyway. He pulls his head back in, confers with the driver, sticks his head back out the window and says, you want a ride? Well, I'm all over that. You know, I'd take a ride in a fire truck any day. So the fireman gets down out of the right side. He opens the door, Paul. It's kind of like limo service. He says, climb up in here. So I climbed up in there. They got the radio up full blast with all these radio calls. They're doing their, you know, they're interacting with other emergency personnel. And we rumble back toward the Skyway. And it's dark, and they've got their lights on. They're, everything they got on this rig is trying to light up the darkness. And I am just totally amazed at, it's an unbelievable experience, and probably my primary emotion of disbelief was what carried me through the day. It's just like I was grateful to be alive. That rose to the surface above disbelief. But we got up toward Skyway and was stopped by the traffic, which was not as intense as it was at 8:30 that morning when I had passed through going east. But we got to within about 100 feet or so. I said, hey, man, thank you very much. Appreciate your service. I'm going to get out here. And I was fully expecting to be chided or to be directed to evacuate. But none of that. They just said, you're welcome. So I got down. I walked toward the Skyway, had my flashlight to make sure that anything that was moving toward me could see that there was a pedestrian. Very few people walking around, but I was walking, and I was moving a lot faster than the traffic just on foot. Went over to my truck, and there it sat under this huge oak tree destined to burn. But there were no flames at that particular time in that particular place. All that burned later on. So another prayer, thank you, God. Hopped in that baby, hopped in my truck, and pulled up to the intersection. It's a little more ordered now where they've got traffic moving through. The officer recognized that I wanted to get through the intersection and so stopped the southbound traffic on Skyway for me and a couple of others to pull out. They headed down Skyway. I headed back up Billy thinking, oh, I'm going to get busted. They're going to come after me and tell me to get out of town. Not a word. They totally had their hands full. So I'm driving now back up Billy, which is the route that the fire truck has just brought me down a few minutes before. I get back to the location where these two homes are fully engulfed in flames, Paul, and the pickup truck is still burning, no explosion yet, but it's grown to five homes and all the trees around it. are burning. And it's moving west towards Skyway, from which I've just come. And it's so intense at this time that the radiant heat off of these flames that are 75 feet high, I mean, a home fully engulfed, and then five homes fully engulfed, makes a serious fire. And by this time, I'm beginning to wonder if I can even get past this. Again, another, a little conference with God. What am I going to do about this? He says, don't wait. Just go for it on the other side of the road. So I gunned it, roared past all these homes, maybe 40, 50 miles an hour. No traffic. But I was thinking that was probably the most danger I was in through the day, because if that tank, the gas tank on that beautiful new truck that was burning had blown at the moment I was trying to get past there, it would have been a serious issue. Went back to the church, sheltered in place, mostly a growing group of elderly people there now. So I parked and I talked, and in every case, Paul, they said, well, I saw my house is gone, or my house is burned. And they're just numb. They're just in a state of disbelief. But these are elderly people who don't even know how to tune their AM radios. By that afternoon, there was a press conference at 3 o'clock. Maybe it was 4 o'clock. And so I helped them. I said, hey, turn your ignition on and let's tune this thing into 1290 AM. Taught them how to listen to their radios. And there were fire reports, but it was mostly confusion on the air because what do we do? This is a big, crazy event, and people are generally moving down and away and out of town, but it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before.
Well, you know, one of the things that everybody wonders about, and when you take a look at the videos and after being in those areas, those exact same areas, driving those roads as you were describing them, one has to wonder about whether the fire department had any ability to fight the fire.
They did, and they stopped when they didn't bother with the landscaping at the post office. They'd let that burn. But when the junipers lit up in front of the Christian Missionary Alliance Church, which is where I was describing as being sheltered in place, those things are explosive. So within 3 or 4 minutes, they came and tried to knock that down. Primarily, they were working on the flaming base of the phone pole that the junipers had ignited in front there, because I think those lines might have been hot. And when a hot wire came down, I witnessed one. They definitely sizzle. You know, there's an electrical discharge. But the fire department was on it. They tried to protect that church. And the reason why the church did not burn is because it was covered with stucco. It wasn't one of those easy igniters. It had quite a bit of distance around it, a perimeter of parking lot, which was my idea for being safe. But from the east side, when those trees, which were 100 feet and taller, across Clark lit up, that was a threat to the church, and that's what started the junipers. So the fire department comes, knocks it down as much as possible. Couple of large trees within 15 to 20 feet of the church partially ignited, but they did not burn like the ponderosa pine trees burned as a torch. So I think that, and I'm sure that the church is intact, and it was intact that day when I left. Eventually, the smoke inhalation got to be a little annoying. We lost power around 10 o'clock, 10:30. Cell service went down because I was with Verizon. But there were an occasional person chatting on a cell phone. I said, well, what kind of cell service are you using? I think they might have said AT&T or one of those others was still up. But mine was my phone was dead, so there was no more posting to Facebook, no more I'm safe, don't worry about me messages. It was just me and these people. So I could deal without the power, could deal with the loss of cell service. I could deal with the loss of water. There were water mains, specifically one that I have a picture of that broke on Clark, and there's just this big, a 3-foot bubbling geyser of precious water that they would use to fight the fire. But they were only doing it in spots. I saw the fire department take on a little spot where an ember had landed down on Billy on my way to rescue or fetch my truck, bring it back. And it was like 10 feet in diameter. So I guess the idea was to inhibit the growth of this uncontrollable fire that was coming by putting out this little patch. So they did, and that they saved that section near Walgreens and Skyway, Billy and Skyway. But for the most part, the fire department was not putting out the fire. That was not there was no putting out this monster. It did not come as a wall, Paul. It swept at times, and you described how it came across Concow in a ferocious burn, a raging fire that was clocked at times at 40 miles an hour. And particularly when it came up the bank from or the canyon, as it came up the canyon wall from the West Fork of the Feather River into Paradise, that whole canyon wall probably, just in my estimation, was climbed in just a couple of minutes. Because burning, tinder dry, uphill, it was just a roaring mess.
After 9 o'clock, please.
So, what's happening is we're sheltering in place, and the one thing that changed my mind about staying was, Tom, there's an expert, and the expert is saying, you know, sometimes there are toxins in this smoke, and I said, I'm aware of that, but I try not to breathe it, and it's as minimal in inhaling as possible. But then she says, sometimes there's poison oak oil in this smoke. I says, poison oak oil? She says, yes.
Yeah.
And I've had bad experiences with poison oak on the outside of me, but I do not want it in my lungs. So at that point, I'm saying, well, the show's done. I've been walking around taking pictures of these fires. You know, it's all day. I've been talking, chatting with people, and it's kind of, I actually took a nap while it all burned around me, and from about 1 to 1:30, because I'm a napper. So you can tell that I was not totally engaged, but I felt safe enough in the parking lot to rest. And then after the rest, I was reinvigorated and ready to go for the rest of the day. Around 4 o'clock, I thought, poison oak, I'm out of here. And that was about the time that the officials came in for probably the second or the third conference where they called the crowd together. They said, look, it's time to go. And we have carved a relatively safe pathway through the destruction. You will all leave now. You will form a single file line. Follow this truck with the lights. Do not stop. Do not turn to the left nor the right. And we'll get you out. So we were obedient. I mean, it was the traffic was clear by that time at 4:30 in the afternoon. The flames have subsided somewhat. What I was going to say is it did not come through in a wall. It came through in pockets. There would be a section on the north that would burn and it would flame up. The pine trees would ignite, and it would be a huge torch for a few seconds. Then it would calm down. Then some other point would light up. The one thing that I noticed was west of the church, there was a group of homes over there, and the fire just systematically burned from where I first saw it that morning. Behind the Mormon church, behind hospice. It lit up a mobile home park, and boy, those things burned like crazy. It moved there north, and it systematically took out one property after another, after another. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't in any big hurry, but there was nobody stopping it. And so we just watched. There was a certain desensitization that happened. You know, you've seen one home burn, and then you've seen 10 homes burn. Well, the 11th and the 12th is nothing new. It's just a matter of, oh, well, there goes another one. And I was thinking, boy, this is just this is a once-in-a-lifetime deal. Never been through anything like this at all. So they said, get in line. You will leave now. So we formed a line. Paul, the destruction I saw around the church with perhaps 20 homes destroyed, and I saw them all burn, was a picnic compared with what I saw south of Billy on Clark as they escorted us out of town.
Right.
All of, and you've seen the pictures.
Oh, yeah, I've been there.
But, well, that afternoon, it's still on fire, but the flames are down to like a foot and a half tall. And there's one building after another building. We're talking about McDonald's burned to the ground. We're talking about Black Bear Diner burned to the ground. But the bear is still standing out there, you know.
Yeah.
The bear with his sign that says, welcome to paradise. And I'm thinking, okay, bear face, I'll be back. It's work. But I'm leaving now. Ace Hardware was just a burned out, it was just a shell, a smoking shell. The gas station at Pearson and Clark, when we drove by, it had been destroyed by fire. The whole Safeway complex at Elliott and Clark had burned. And, oh, my gosh, Papa Murphy's was gone. Yeah. Oh, you know.
I used to get pizzas there myself.
Hey, well, I was thinking on fire day they'd be especially hot. Anyway, I'm thinking, well, part of me is thinking I got to get some footage of this. This is totally unbelievable. The other part, my heart is, you know, I'd been desensitized up there watching it burn fairly slowly around the church compared with this. But once again, I realized this was a disaster of huge, huge proportions. There were very few buildings that were left standing. I was really concerned about the Paradise Performing Arts Center, just west of Clark, up Nunnally, and I, you know, it was all I could do to keep myself from turning up that direction because I'd be in bad graces with the fire department if I got out of line. So I just drove. I didn't try to take any pictures. I was doing everything I could to avoid the debris. I mean, they cleared the trees as much as possible and the phone poles that had come down, but there were wires everywhere. They'd been de-energized, I'm sure, and if they weren't, I wasn't going to stop and think about it. I was just following the crowd, and they drove over those things totally against my nature of concern when I see something like this. It was a matter of survival, and we were on the path of safety, but the phone poles, they had reversed roles with the wires. Usually, the phone poles support the wires. This time, the wires were supporting dangling phone poles that were burning up, and half of them were gone. They were in flames. I mean, the bottom of the phone pole was just doing a slow flame up toward the top. I mean, there were burned out automobiles to the side. And there were things that when they said watch for falling trees, they weren't kidding because these things would just come down after they've been burning for an hour or two, and there was no way that the emergency personnel had control of this. They just said, keep your eyes open and avoid all of these things. So I'm, you know, driving around all of this stuff, and I'm just thankful that I'm alive. The flamed destruction went all the way down Clark. I'm talking about almost to Butte College, and that's perhaps 6 to 7 miles there was destruction. And it was most intense in Paradise, but the fire had just swept across all the landscaping. I mean, all the all the canyons that had brush around on the outside of town. And finally, the smoke cleared and the sky was clear when we got down to Butte College. And from that point, the crowd dispersed. I headed toward Oroville because I knew about Oro Naz Church. And sure enough, there was the Red Cross. They were there, Paul. They were on the scene. They were setting up. They had food. They were bringing in the cots. Truckloads of cots came in. They were setting them up at 10:30 or 11 o'clock that night. And I actually had a cot to sleep on. And I say that the 3 days that I spent there, I had three hots in a cot. And I was grateful for that. I had a backpack and a truck, and that was everything to my life. So I realized that moving on from that point was going to be a simple matter. It was the biggest declutter program and the fastest that I've ever been through in my life. It all burned. And there's good things about that, but there's sobering things about that too, because we're talking the loss of family pictures and precious things. All the tools, my beloved chainsaw, but I don't think about that kind of stuff because I'm looking forward. I'm saying, okay, well, what's next? I have these conferences with my Lord, my God, and I believe that he protects me and has directed me to this point.
Let me ask you a question. Are you going to go back to Paradise and rebuild?
Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I say yes. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, I say no way. Sundays, I don't think about it. The way the insurance is set up now, and I got to put in a plug for the Hartford, those people, they were good. They started moving money into my account within about 2 or 3 days afterwards. And so, and they didn't give me the usual pushback and hemming and hawing, or you need to find receipts for all your personal possessions. They're just good. They were concerned. Admittedly, when I first called answering your rebuild question. When I first called from the shelter a couple days afterwards, I get an operator who says, okay, thank you for your number, your insurance number, which is one thing that I had stuffed in my backpack. So they went right to my policy and said, oh yes, you're insured, sir. What we're going to do is we're going to send out an adjuster to walk through your home and to assess the damage. And I said, ma'am, you can do that, but there's no home to walk through. So there was a moment of silence at the end of the line. And by that time, I realized that the operator understood. And she said to me, you mean it's a total loss? Yes, as far as I know. Now, I did not know. I had not confirmation at that time that my home was a total loss. It might have been standing, but I thought, I need to move the insurance thing along pretty well because everybody I'd talked to and the extent of the destruction in Paradise indicated that I can hope, but that house is probably gone.
Sure.
And ultimately, I ended up with pictures from relatives who somehow ended up with pictures of my property, and there was the flag that was flying on the pine tree up about 15 feet in front of the place had come down in this firestorm, and one of the firefighters or somebody who was in there had propped it back up so that it was flying once again from the lamppost. And as far as I know, the lamppost is still there along with the chimney, but the house is gone.
Well, listen, Ken, we got to stop right now because we're coming up against the end of the hour, and I want to thank you very much for all that you contributed. We gave you the whole hour to get your story out, and I really do appreciate this information. And, you know, Godspeed to you, and I really appreciate you being on the radio show.
Happy to do it, Paul. Happy to do it.
Thank you very much. Ken Boone, his story from Paradise on November 8th. Anyway, thanks for listening to Agenda 21 Radio. Remember to visit our website, agenda21radio.news or 821r.com, and also newcaliforniastate.com, the state of the future. Stay strong, America. We are exceptional Americans.
We're sending out an SOS to the last vestiges of freedom, democracy, and the American way of life. Paul Preston with Agenda 21.
Stay tuned for more of Paul Preston's Agenda 21 Radio.
This is AENN, American Exceptionalism News Network.